Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Well, until recently, the Right Reverend Dr. Michael Nazir Ali was the 106th Bishop of Rochester in the UK and a member of the House of Lords. Born in Pakistan, he studied economics, sociology and Islamic history at the University of Karachi. He went on to study at Cambridge, Oxford and Harvard universities, earning numerous degrees and doctorates. As a bishop, he has dedicated his life to the poor and to defending the Christian faith. And as someone who has championed interfaith dialogue, studied Sharia law for 30 years and lived under both moderate and extreme Islam, he is well positioned to comment on the effects of radical Islam on societies and their citizens, as well as things like radical secularism and a number of other ideologies. He's been brought out to Australia this time by Family Voice Australia and is with us in the studio now, Bishop Michael, if I may call you that. It's wonderful to have you in the studio and to talk to you again.
But it's nice to see you again.
You stepped down as Bishop of Rochester and relinquished your seat in the House of Lords last year. You were relatively young to do that. Tell me about why. Why you actually made that decision?
Well, I'd been feeling for some time that God was calling me to do something different. I've been a bishop now for nearly 26 years. Well, actually more than 26 years this month. And church leaders, particularly in churches where Christians have experienced persecution for their faith, were asking for help. And I was already, of course, engaged in interfaith dialogue, as you have said. And I felt that it was time to respond to the needs that I knew were there and I could see them. So that's why, really.
And no doubt your homeland, Pakistan, would be one of those areas where you...
Well, certainly. Many areas in the Middle East, Pakistan, Nigeria, the Sudan, a number of places. But of course, I have also realized more recently that this does not exclude the Western world, because Christians are now experiencing restrictions on their activities, questions of conscience. They are unable to hold certain posts if they have Christian beliefs and so on.
All right. Well, you talk about the Western world. Let's talk about that then. The Western world facing a triple jeopardy. Just explain what you mean by that.
Yes, I've used that as a kind of convenient title. What I mean is that the three challenges of aggressive secularism, which is undermining the Judeo-Christian basis of many Western societies, and that undermining is happening at the same time as the challenge of radical Islamism, and then multiculturalism, which was really a philosophy developed because public Christian discourse was being lost in Western societies. There was a kind of amnesia about it. And people said, well, we don't know who we are. And those who were coming to live in their countries, like Britain, we don't know who you are, so let us carry on living separately. Mm-hmm. And that produced isolated, segregated communities and was an opportunity, actually, for extremism also to develop. Now, I think the proper basis for welcoming people should have been Christian hospitality, to say, this is how we have been formed as a people, as a nation. This is the basis for our laws, our institutions, our values, our customs. You are welcome now on this basis and welcome to contribute.
Whereas we've kind of, the Western world in general has kind of let go of that, lost their Christian identity in many ways, and now we don't know who we are.
Well, that's right. I think the word tolerance is often used in Britain. I don't know about here. Mm. And tolerance really means leaving people alone rather than welcoming them, integrating them, producing a common citizenship, some common core values, a shared language. I mean, these are the things that make a country work.
Well, I'm very keen to then explore those three topics that you've just raised there: aggressive secularism, radical Islam, and multiculturalism. And just give us some examples of how that has played out then in your, well, I was going to say your home country. I guess, yes, both in many ways, Pakistan and Britain is your home country, but I'm, yes, thinking of Britain.
Yes.
And how that's worked out. Just the first one there, aggressive secularism. Just what have you seen?
Mm. Well, what aggressive secularism has done is to undermine the basic units of society, for example, marriage and the family. It affirms, on the one hand, human dignity, but on the other hand, it offends against it by policies on abortion, on embryonic stem cell research, now increasing pressure for voluntary euthanasia or assisted suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And so the absoluteness of values that the Christian faith has provided, that human dignity, for instance, is inalienable. It cannot be taken from human beings at whatever stage of life. That is undermined. It has also meant that the explicitly Christian basis for society is questioned. So the claim is made, we are a secular society. Well, that may be true in some respects, but actually in a country like Britain, the whole basis of the constitution and parliament and all of that arises from a Christian vision.
Mm.
And to deny it is actually to endanger the situation and perhaps for totalitarianism and authoritarianism to develop in the name of liberal values.
Mm-hmm. It's often said that secularism is kind of this neutral space, so that all the various, you know, religious and other ideologies can come and kind of have this conversation.
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
Secularism
concept?
Is not neutral. There is no such thing as neutrality in this area. Secularism is also a worldview, a point of view, and the sooner we realize it, the better. Because by playing at neutrality, secularism actually gets what it wants. And people in Britain, for instance, have to decide whether they want to go with the alleged neutrality of secularism or with the tried and tested Christian values that have made Britain what it is.
Mm-hmm. This is Open House. Bishop Dr. Micah Nazir Ali is with us, former Bishop of Rochester in the UK, and now very much a minister at large, particularly to the persecuted church, I guess you might say, those Christians around the world who are actually finding themselves persecuted, but also quite an expert on both Islam and also secularism, given the fact that he's experienced both in the various countries that he's lived and worked. So you've talked about secularism. Now, the second one of those triple jeopardies you were saying the Western world is facing is radical Islam.
Yes.
What have you seen in Britain that's happened there?
Well, what I say about this is that Christians should, of course, love Muslims. There is no exception to this. They should respect their faith and their piety and their devotion. But radical Islamism is a comprehensive economic, social, and political ideology, analogous, very similar to Marxism, for example.
Mm.
And indeed, it is the first such ideology that has appeared since the demise of Marxism. Now, it has appeared at least to challenge Western countries and cultures at exactly the same time that the power and the authority of Christian discourse is being lost in these societies. So there is a moral and spiritual vacuum, which, of course, it is very possible that an ideology like radical Islamism will fill.
Just to what degree have you seen that becoming more of a concern in Britain? I mean, it's almost, there's been various statements from various leaders about maybe we can incorporate aspects of Sharia law into common law and things like that. What have you seen that's been most alarming?
Well, I think the most alarming thing is, of course, homegrown terrorism, that young people have been radicalized, whether around the margins of the mosque or the madrasa or through the internet or in places of higher education or in prison. These are the places where radicalization has occurred. And people have been found now to have no loyalty to their own country. They have some other loyalty in the cause of which they have been planning terrorist attacks. And one after another, these cases have occurred. So that should be worrying for everybody, and it has arisen directly out of a mistaken policy of multiculturalism, which has allowed communities to develop separately.
Okay, which is just third point. Yeah.
That's right. However, once it emerged, there's also been a move to appease radical Islamism rather than to face it. And that also is dangerous because the more you appease it, the more it will demand.
How's it been appeased in Britain?
Well, for example, by finding ways of providing state funds to Islamist organizations to make sure that they don't go even further in their extremism. But also in bringing legislation, for instance, to Parliament on things like incitement to religious hatred. And it was the House of Lords, actually, that mitigated the effects of such legislation by introducing an amendment that exempted preaching, for example, or evangelism or scholarship
mm-hmm.
from the purview of such a law.
Mm-hmm. We've got something similar in Victoria now.
Yes, I'm aware of that.
Yeah. Now, some would actually say, well, that's there to, in many ways, protect just moderate Islam or any other religion. The whole idea being, well, in Victoria it's actually called the racial vilification law, so you're not to vilify any particular racial or religious group. Isn't there some kind of value for it to that end?
Already the international covenants to which Britain is a signatory, and also Australia, I expect, prevent incitement to religious hatred, for example, when there is a danger that it would lead to discrimination or violence. So there is no need for de novo legislation. But I think we must be very careful about also preserving free speech, freedom of belief, freedom of expression, freedom to change your beliefs.
Mm.
And anything that hinders that or closes down the possibilities there has to be viewed with concern.
Mm. Okay, so those three aspects of that triple jeopardy you're saying the Western world is facing: secularism, radical Islam, and then multiculturalism. When you then come and visit Australia with what you have seen elsewhere in the world, and particularly in Britain, what, again, kind of raises some alarm bells for you in light of those three ideas?
Well, of course, when I come to a country like Australia, my desire is, first of all, to learn from people who live here about what is happening. But what I seem to hear from them is that you are going very much in that direction. I mean, you just mentioned laws preventing incitement to religious hatred and the implications of that for free speech, for example. Questions of conscience, you are facing the same ones about adoption, for example. In Britain, we've had a long tradition of recognizing conscience in legislation. But in recent legislation about adoption, for example, that conscience of religious believers has not been recognized. And I think this is another step on the way to authoritarianism. Now, it may be that you are not as far ahead or as far behind, depending on how you see it, as Britain. But you certainly seem to be headed that way.
Open House is what you're listening to. We're just talking about secularism, radical Islam, and multiculturalism, the triple jeopardy that Bishop Dr. Michael Nazir Ali says that the Western world is actually facing. 1-300-40-20-20 for your thoughts. Now, when it comes to this notion of a Christian nation, and therefore there being this underpinning of the Christian faith as to the way a particular nation works out, some would even question that and say, well, can you really have a Christian nation? All you can really have is Christian citizens, and can you legislate Christianity? You can't force people to think or to act or to have a Christian conscience. So what's
no, there's no question of coercion. I mean, this is about persuasion. It is about the quality of our arguments, and that has always been the case and should be the case. However, there is no neutral vacuum, as it were, in the public square. If you don't have the assumptions and the principles of the Christian faith, you will have something else. And that's the point that people have to grasp. There is no question that in Britain and in many places in Europe, but not only there, the civilization and the culture and the political arrangements in many ways have been formed by a Christian vision of what society should be like. Now, if people are saying they don't want such a vision, are they wanting then also to get rid of the achievements? That has to do with the dignity of the human person, with equality, with liberty, all of those fundamental values. And if so, what are they going to put in its place? And so far, I've not seen very much that can be put in its place. So these Christian bases for society are not excluding, but the very means of including people. That is why I mentioned Christian hospitality. Peter Hitchens, who is Christopher Hitchens' brother, you know, the famous atheist, he has come to faith recently, and he's written a book called The Rage Against God, in which he has shown that actually free societies have acquired their freedom from a Christian basis, and that the only thing that atheism leads to is totalitarianism and authoritarianism. Now, he needs to be listened to, because for 17 years, I think, he was a journalist in the Soviet Union.
Mm-hmm. Right, and he saw it firsthand, what actually happens with the totalitarian regime. We kind of think, and we listen in Australia, and we kind of think, oh, that could never happen here. You know, we can never have a totalitarian regime here in Australia. You know, radical Islam will always be kind of fought against in Australia. To what degree could a country like Britain or a country like ours actually fall to some sort of totalitarian regime?
Well, if we find that Christians, for example, because of their faith, cannot hold certain jobs, they're not allowed the luxury of conscience. If we find that people are excluded from public life because they are Christians, then we are on the way to a kind of alleged liberal secular totalitarianism. I'm not saying it's arrived yet, but certainly the signs are that it might, and that is why we have to be vigilant.
What are some of the signs that you've seen in Britain?
Well, we've seen civil registrars, for instance, who have simply said when there is a same-sex civil partnership being needing officiating at, leave us out, please. But they've been told no, even though there are many other registrars willing to carry out this officiating, you must do it.
Is that right?
You must do it.
So Christian pastors, for instance, are actually kind of...
Well, not pastors, but civil registrars, certainly.
Okay.
So far, well, there has been pressure even for pastors. And in the last government, before the election, there was a bill to allow civil partnerships in churches. That may all come back. But at the moment, if you're a Christian, you can't be a civil registrar. Magistrates who've been serving on benches have been told that unless you participate in the signing of same-sex adoption papers, you cannot be a magistrate. It's not just that you should abstain or be absent, but you cannot be a magistrate. The same with specialists like doctors, pediatricians, and so forth. I'm aware of 48 such cases where people have been removed from their jobs or suspended because they have in some way manifested their faith at their place of work.
That is concerning, isn't it?
Very.
Yeah, very concerning. So what do you see as the way forward for this point on? Because there'd be a number of people who may not even be Christians who might say, okay, that doesn't seem to be fitting right, and if we're following along the lines of where Britain is going, we don't like the direction that your country at the very least is heading, and we've got some aspects of that. Where to from here for both? Let's just focus for the time being on people of faith, Christian faith, and people of goodwill, citizens just simply in Australia who just are also concerned about this.
Well, it's not for me to prescribe, of course, but your constitution already acknowledges the blessings of Almighty God. And that is a very good place to start, to say we are who we are because of the Bible and because of the wider Judeo-Christian tradition. We still need that tradition to make decisions about the dignity of human persons at any stage of life. We still need that tradition. Otherwise, how are we going to make those decisions? You see, what happens by default is that you make decisions through opinion poll or focus groups or what I call the yuck factor, which is, you know, what the public will not accept. And then you work on the public and lo and behold, 5 years later, they will after all accept.
Sure. Well, we've all seen examples of that.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Yeah. So you to make moral and spiritual decisions in the public place, I'm not now talking about what people do at home or what they think or what they believe, but in the public place, you need a moral and spiritual tradition to make certain kinds of decision about justice, about equality, about liberty, about dignity, safety from harm of vital social institutions. And to do that, you need a moral and spiritual tradition. Now, if you're not going to have Christianity, what are you going to have?
What would you say to people who say, well, this is a democracy. The fact is that we could kind of, you know, if there was enough groundswell of support, then we would just go and remove some of those aspects out of our constitution so we could actually have a different society.
Okay, so
it's only a vote away.
It is quite possible to develop popular support in due course for killing infants who are born with severe deformities. Is that enough? I mean, is that enough for us to say, well, 90% of the public says, yes, it's not worth them surviving. I mean, that has happened in the past. You know, one of the things the church used to do in the early days was to rescue babies who'd been left exposed to die by their parents. Democracy in itself is not enough. Counting heads is not enough. We need some way of forming our minds and hearts, our consciences, about what is right and what is wrong.
And to the secularist listening who would say, but I'm not going to do that, you know, I'm a part of this democracy, I can vote the way I want, and I wouldn't, you know, go and, you know, expose a child to that. Why don't we continue on with the idea of Australia being a secular humanist country?
Well, it's for Australians to answer that question, but whether you are going to do something or not going to do something, I wouldn't be complacent about that. I mean, who would have thought that the highly civilized middle Europe of Austria and Germany would actually do some of the things that they did do? They had false ideas about race that they had derived from scientific terminology, illegitimately derived from it, but they did derive it from there. They practice eugenics. I don't see why, if you haven't got any kind of moral or spiritual basis for thinking about these things, why you shouldn't end up doing them. I mean, there are always enough persuasive people to show you why you should.
Some will then say, okay, well, we saw that some parts of the Christian church, when it came to Nazi Germany, actually supported them. So what is the role of the committed Christian in stopping this slide?
Yes, some parts of the church did capitulate, and you will find that some parts of the church will capitulate now, indeed are capitulating. But there was a confessing church. There were people who held up the gospel of Jesus Christ, even in that terrible situation of National Socialism, and suffered for it and died for it, in fact. And that also needs to happen now, that Christians will be light in the world, so that people can see why it is that they uphold these values, that these values have to do with God's purpose for the lives of human beings.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the second of the triple jeopardy that you're talking about that's facing the Western world, radical Islam. Now, what can people of faith, people of goodwill, and also Muslims themselves, moderate Muslims who are listening, many of them listen to this program, what can they do? What's the role of those three groups in stemming the direction that you have seen in other countries, even partly in Britain? And we might even see, you know, we've seen some homegrown radical Islamic groups actually here in Australia. What's our role, those three groups?
Well, I don't know about each of them, but generally speaking, what has happened is that when radical Islamists have said something which they have claimed is rooted in their fundamental documents of faith, moderate Muslims have sometimes, often perhaps, offered another interpretation. And that is good. We want to see moderate Muslims do that more and more. I have many friends and colleagues who do. But I also have to say, in all honesty, that in the end, the radical Islamist view very often prevails. And that should be a concern to us and also to moderate Muslims, of course. It is very important for Western leaders, whether church leaders or civic or political leaders, not to speak about things of which they are ignorant. I mean, for instance, to say from out of nowhere almost that aspects of Sharia should be incorporated into systems of public law in the West. I mean, this is nonsense, because systems of public law in the West, which have developed out of the Judeo-Christian tradition, demonstrably so, contradict the assumptions of Sharia. I mean, take family law, for instance. The assumptions that underlie, well, all public law in Western countries is that of equality. In public law, this works out in terms of the equality of man and woman, in questions of marriage, of divorce, of custody of children, of inheritance, of the admissibility of evidence. Whereas in Sharia, there is structural inequality in all of those areas. And that's only one example. So we have to be very careful about what we do to accommodate these radical views. Of course, Muslims, like anyone else, should be free to practice their faith, and to have places of worship, and to be formed by their faith in whatever way they choose. But no one should be prevented from having access to the courts, for example, simply because they have participated in some religious activity within their own community.
Mm-hmm.
And no one should be deprived of the protection of the state if they are exposed to any kind of injustice or coercion or violence.
Mm-hmm. All right, and then the third point of multiculturalism. What do you see as the way forward there? Interestingly enough, I mean, you're Pakistani-born. You know, you spent years in Britain. You tour the world. Some people say, oh, you're speaking against multiculturalism. I really have to understand who you are. I mean, what is the alternative to multiculturalism?
Christian hospitality. I'm not saying that nations are not multicultural. I mean, obviously they are. Britain is and Australia is, and that's something to be welcomed, and cultures are to be celebrated. My problem is with that little ism suffix. So often the problem is with words that end in ism, and they're Marxism, multiculturalism, so on.
Hmm.
That is a philosophy about how a country should be, which refuses to privilege any spiritual or moral tradition. And we have seen that the result of that is confusion among the young particularly, but generally confusion. People don't know where they've come from, what their nation stands for, what is the basis for a common citizenship, and what is the basis for making important decisions in public life.
Some have said that we might be able to say something along the lines of a country can be multi-ethnic but not multicultural.
Yes, I don't mind multicultural. I think it's multiculturalism
is the problem. Yeah, okay, which is therefore the philosophy that allows no one dominance.
Yes.
Leave us with then the case for the Christian worldview for being the basis of Australian society, indeed of Western society as a whole. Leave us with the reasons why, based on the past, as a vision for the future.
Well, lots of things can be said, but just two might suffice. One is that the biblical vision is about answering the why and the what for questions. Why is there something rather than nothing? Why is the universe as it is? Why am I here? And we need those answers to those questions. And then the what for question. What am I here for? Question about destiny and purpose. You know, a leading psychiatrist said in Britain the other day, I can prescribe Prozac for people, but I can't give them purpose in life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Bible is about purpose. And that brings me to my second point. The idea that time is a forward-moving thing that enables human beings, and also God, of course, we believe, to fulfill purposes in our lives. This is an idea unique to the Bible. All the other ancient religious traditions had a cyclical view of time, that time went round and round and everything got repeated endlessly.
Hmm.
It is this view of time, drawn from the Bible, that has made progress possible in our world, because we think now progressively. And what secularization has done is to have removed this idea of time from the sacred sphere. You know, the sacredness of time was seen by those high points in the year, for example, that turned our attention from the mundane to the divine. They used to be known as holy days,
mm-hmm.
and secularization has turned them into holidays.
That's a very interesting point to leave on. That whole notion of our Western idea of time has actually come from the Christian, the biblical basis of Western society. Great to catch up with you again, Bishop Dr. Michael Nesrelli. Yeah, thank you very much for your time. Appreciate it.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.